You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. I'm Campbell Barron, or at Campbell J. Barron on Instagram and Twitter. Welcome to the program. So the year is 2020. We're living through a global pandemic, spending more time than we usually do in the summer at home, and consuming our news and headlines from all over the place. All the while, distrust in media is quite high, and it has been like that for the past few years. And this is a narrative that is heavily tied to politics. And as a result of all of this, I am really excited for today's guest, because in 2016, Jim VandeHei, previously one of the co-founders of Politico, noticed many inefficiencies that are a byproduct of mainstream news organizations and decided to solve these inefficiencies with a new kind of media startup. How? Well, in January of 2017, VandeHei launched Axios to the World, and 3 years later, the company is doing well. They have a show called Axios on HBO, a few podcasts, one of my favorites being Axios Today, in addition to prominent newsletters and a substantial social media presence, sharing news aimed at getting you, quote, smarter, faster on what matters. But perhaps one of the most interesting factors in regards to the Axios story is the positioning of the company. They're a for-profit startup media company. They've actually, in fact, raised over $50 million from companies including NBC and philanthropists including Lauren Powell Jobs. Needless to say, Jim VandeHei is the co-founder and CEO of Axios. He's based in Washington, D.C., and he's been involved in journalism and politics for most of his career. And as a fan of Axios and Jim's work, I knew I wanted to have him on the program to discuss the origin story of the company, where the startup is heading, and of course, how Axios is paving the way for the next generation of great media companies in the extremely saturated world of on-demand content. That's all coming up. This is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. My conversation with Axios co-founder and CEO Jim VandeHei starts now. Well, I'm a really big fan of Axios. I listen to Axios Today every morning, and that's how I get my news. I frequent your website, check the crazy coronavirus stats. I've also watched a couple of episodes of Axios on HBO, and so I'm really excited to talk to you about the future of media. But I think before we get into that, if you can kind of introduce yourself, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Jim VandeHei, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Axios.
And it seems like you've spent pretty much all of your career involved in some form of journalism. How did you get interested in journalism in the first place? And were you at all entrepreneurial at a young age?
I wasn't. It's interesting because I'm not your typical media success story that I always wanted to be a journalist or always wanted to be an entrepreneur. In high school, I was at best a below average student. Was much more interested in girls and drinking than I was in reading or thinking about my career. And even early in college was at best a lackluster student. And I'd say 2.5 years into college, I started to get my head out of my ass and think about what I wanted to do. And I was always a good writer and I was really into sports at the time. And so I decided to switch to journalism. And even before I switched to journalism, I went to our daily newspaper and just said, I know a lot about sports. I think I'm a good writer. Can I be a sports writer? And the guy was nice enough to give me a test and see if I could write and pull it off. And I did well enough that he let me cover high school sports. And so I started full-time as a sports writer in college. And from there, I was hooked. I loved it. I'm like, here's something I love doing that I can get paid to do.
Awesome. Well, I think that's when you find out what you're interested in, I think it's a really it's a kind of magical moment there. And it seems like your entry point into the world of journalism was in 2000 when you were at the Wall Street Journal. Am I correct?
No, it was earlier than that because I had done some sports journalism in college. And then probably the best thing that ever happened to me was I had picked up the phone one day in Wisconsin and called every newspaper in the state and volunteered to intern for free. And I happened to call a guy who ran a weekly newspaper in a small town called Brilliant, Wisconsin. And he said, well, it's interesting that you called today. Can you drive up here and meet me? And I drove up there and met him. And I explained to him that I haven't really taken a journalism class yet, but I was doing some sports writing. And he said, yeah, whatever. He goes, will you run my newspaper? And I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, my editor just said he's quitting if I won't let him go to Finland for 3 months. So if you would agree right now, I'll teach you how to run my newspaper. I'll teach you every aspect of it in the next week. I will give you $350 a week, a new car to use for 3 months, and I'll give you my cottage on the water.
Oh my God.
With a refrigerator full of beer.
It's like a game show deal. My first
executive package. And I learned more in that summer than I would learn in the totality of college about journalism, about people and politics and farming, and basically discovered that in journalism, you get paid to learn. And at times you get paid to stir up mischief and hold people accountable. And I loved it. And so I moved out to DC right when I graduated college to become a journalist, and a political journalist very specifically, and worked my way up from small publications to Roll Call when I was in my late 20s. And it happened to break some pretty big stories, and ended up at the Wall Street Journal at a relatively young age, covering the White House and Congress.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, because, you know, you ended up, went on to start Politico, I think in 2006. What inefficiencies did you spot early on in your career in regards to how the journalism world worked, perhaps at the Wall Street Journal? What was kind of the spark that led you to want to start a publication?
Yeah, had you asked me at the time, I would not have said that I'm an entrepreneur. I always thought my journalism was pretty entrepreneurial. I never liked to write what everyone else liked to write. When I covered the presidency, I hated kind of flying around with the rest of the press corps writing about the same thing. I thought it was a waste of energy. So I'd always try to find different ways into thinking about the presidency and thinking about power. And so I guess I was entrepreneurial in my journalism. And in retrospect, I always had ideas about how to improve publications. And when I was at the Washington Post, the internet was taking off. It was becoming pretty clear that more people were consuming Post content online than they were in the newspaper. And I was had one of the better beats at the Washington Post. I could write about anything, the presidency, politics, lobbying, and I talked to my editor, John Harris, at the time, and I was just like, we're not that great. Like, the Post has this amazing reputation, but if we got like six or seven of us and we took advantage of the internet, and we took advantage of cable TV's insatiable appetite for content and our own reputations, like, we could take on the Post. Mm-hmm. And kind of, not on a lark, but pretty quickly just decided, what the hell, let's go do it. And so we did it. And so, like, my journey from journalist to, or transformation from journalist to entrepreneur, unfolded over literally a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And then we became entrepreneurs and started Politico. And that's really where I shifted. I shifted from I'm a journalist to now I am a entrepreneur to pretty quickly I'm a CEO. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's even, journalism was as much fun as I thought I could get paid to have. This is even more fun. Running companies, starting companies. It's intoxicating. It's addictive. It's something I would do for free. And luckily I've gotten paid decently to do both of them. And that's like what you said earlier. It really is a trick. I was talking to some college kids just a couple of days ago. And I said, the key to life is if you think about time, most of us should sleep 6 to 7 hours a day. So you have, let's say, 17 to 18 hours a day. By the time you become a professional, you're either physically working or going to work or thinking about work anywhere from 60 to 100% of your waking hours. And so the trick is to find something that you would do for free and get paid for it, because then 80% or 60%, whatever percentage of time that you're thinking about work is joy. Like, it's joyful. Like, 99% of what I do right now, I love doing. I'd happily do it forever. Mm-hmm.
And you're set. And I think that's a really important statement. I really resonate with that. So you were at Politico from 2006 to 2016.
Yep.
And from 2006 to 2016, it seems like just the media world dramatically changed. The landscape just completely shifted. What changes did you notice during that period of time? And did at all did the business model dramatically shift within those 10 years? Because, I mean, you know, 2006. Yeah. So what changed?
I mean, you basically went from you're probably even too young to have been to fully appreciate it, but it was kind of a static world. It was a static industry. Like, newspapers did well, TV did well, and they did well for 30, 40 years. And then suddenly they didn't. And suddenly everything moved to digital. And all the things that worked in a physical paper world didn't translate well to digital. And it was a very awkward transition for most companies, much like you see with the retail sector, right? Like these great brands that loom so large in our lives, loom large till they crumbled almost instantaneously and died away. And that happened with the media. And so what we saw happening was people wanted content digitally. That meant they wanted it differently in terms of they wanted more voice in their journalism. They wanted more immediacy. They wanted more interaction. It changed the type of advertising that you could run. It gave you access to way more people than you had before, but you know, newspapers really struggled with figuring out how to monetize it. So it was just a radically different world. And we really lived it, you know, through the totality of Politico. Like it really, we sort of took off and kind of probably had a pretty big advantage because we were native to the digital world. We got a lot of attention because we were one of the few success stories. And we were covering politics, which once the world moved from print to digital, politics became, you know, went from maybe being 5 or 10% of the coverage to, it seemed like 80% of people's public sort of attention span. And so
the timing was well-timed.
And that's another important thing. Like a really good idea at the wrong time can be a bad idea. A decent idea at the right time can be a brilliant idea. And that's one of the things, like these mythical figures that we create in business, or, and I think a lot of business leaders almost take on a mythicism in their own minds of how great they are and how smart they are. So much of this is shithouse luck. And so much of it is like getting around the right people who basically offset your weaknesses or amplify your strengths. And then there's some kind of magical chemistry between moment and people and kind of the interaction of those people to create a company. So like I've never been, it's not false humility either. Like I'm not delusional that yes, Politico was a really big success. Axios is a big success. Obviously I contributed to both of those, but I've never thought like, that was me. And like, I could have done that with anybody. Like, no, like take 5, 6, 7, 8 people out of the founding of both of those companies. And I don't know if they survive. They certainly don't become as successful as they became. And so there's an arrogance about how we worship some of the great entrepreneurs, and many deserve a lot of the praise that they get, but worship is dangerous.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think from talking to various entrepreneurs, I think I've picked up on the idea that there's only essentially a moment of time where an idea would work. And anything before is too early and anything after is too late. And so the core amount of luck, right, when you say I got lucky, is for pretty much being at the right place at the right time with the right group of people. And I think you said that really well. So 2016 was also an interesting year. Seems like a pivotal year just in regards to media. So Trump got elected. Distrust in mainstream media was very high. And that was, you know, as that was partly due to the political environment. That's when that's the first year I think I started hearing terms like fake news. And as a result of all this, or maybe not as a result, but it happens to be at the same amount of time, in August of 2016, you decided to start a news organization called Axios. Like I said at the top of the show, I'm a really big fan of Axios. It's where my core place of getting news. I like your show on HBO. I listen to Axios Today in the morning. I read some of your articles. But the idea to launch a for-profit news startup in 2016 is definitely a bold idea. It's not like there weren't news companies or news outlets in 2016 already. How did Axios come to be, and why did you feel the need to build another news organization? What's the inception story?
Well, the reason you create any company is you feel like that something's missing, that the that there's a solution that some slice of humanity needs that you think you can provide, and that if you provide it, you can monetize it. And what we saw happening was, if you are somebody who really cares about the world and really cares about news, starting about, you know, maybe 12 years ago, the world started to move faster than the human mind is basically equipped to keep up with. It requires, things are moving so fast because of technology across every sector and every aspect of our life, that it was going to require all of us to become a lot smarter, faster. We were going to have to know more about more topics than ever before if we're going to be truly informed to make better decisions about our life, make better decisions about our job. And so we thought, okay, if that is the fundamental problem, what is the solution? And our solution was smart brevity, which is you have to combine the smartest coverage of the most important topics with the essential ingredient of brevity, meaning how can I make information consumption more efficient? Why is that important? Because there's not a single person who is in a job today or living today that does not feel overwhelmed by the crush of information coming at them from so many directions.
Definitely.
They have less time to allocate to information consumption at a time where they actually need to be consuming more information in total. And so you had to crack the efficiency part of it. And we had seen sides of this at Politico that's what especially like your elite readers, your people who are leading media or business or technology or presidents or Congress, they were hungry for brevity. They were hungry for smart brevity. And that was the origin. It was Mikey and myself and Roy Schwartz and Kayla Cook, who became Kayla Brown, who's with us at Politico. Those were the conversations we had after we left Politico about what does the world need and what do we think we could create to meet that demand. And luckily, we were very confident that we were right about the solution, and the solution really has taken on, and in some ways has taken on a life of its own now. Now we have, as you mentioned, a podcast, Axios Today. We've got Dan Primack does a podcast in the evening for us. We have a television show called Axios on HBO. We've got, you know, almost 24 newsletters. We've got an app, a website. But it's all predicated on smart brevity, like really intelligent coverage of things that matter. Mm-hmm. And we're not, unlike Politico, where we were all politics, like politics matters. It doesn't matter as much as people are making it out to be. Like it, like obviously Trump looms large over everything, but I'm sorry, like the growing threat of China is a bigger topic than who's
climate change,
right. AI, you name it. Those are the those are the big sort of existential questions/threats confronting all of us. And our job is to help people better understand them.
Coming up, I continue my conversation with Axios co-founder and CEO Jim Vandehei. We'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsor. Welcome back to the One to Succeed in my conversation with Axios co-founder and CEO Jim Vandehei. So, actually, what is it? What does Axios mean? Where'd you get the name?
It's Greek for worthy, which obviously fits the mission really well. We want to be worthy of your time, worthy of your attention, covering worthy topics. You know, the way you come to it is it's almost impossible to name a company. Certainly, you know, you want something short. You want a URL, so a website that you can own. And it took us weeks of going through tons of names to get to Axios, which in retrospect, I think was a really a brilliant name because it, to most people, unless you're Greek, it doesn't mean anything. And it allowed us to create an identity for it. And, you know, and so it's work. It's like, I mean, Politico, which my wife had named, was probably the best name you could ever have, right?
For
a company. Like it says exactly what it is and who reads it. And so Axios is more elastic and I think has bigger ambitions than I think we had at Politico. So I think it fits it well.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember any of the other potential names?
Oh, we had a bunch that we went through. Level was one of them, L-E-V-E-L. Different versions of Sync, S-Y-N-C, Sync. Was one, you know, we were always trying to get at sort of the truth. Vital was one.
Vital.
Yale was one. You end up, it's hard, I think, you know, you don't want to go into the weeds. It's hard to buy, if you're a media company, you're public, so people know you. And so you can't hide. And so you have to be trademarked here, at least here and in Europe. And you have to be able to buy the URL. It's a lot harder than people would think. It's why you have a lot of weird named companies now.
Yeah, Axios.co wouldn't really cut it, especially being a media company that people search for. So what was the plan at this point? Like it started in 2016 and launched in January of 2017. To date, Axios has raised $57 million in venture funding. So it's a startup, right? It's a startup media company. But walk me through the company's history in regards to the fundraising process. How early on did you raise money? And what did you actually do to execute on this idea that you had? for a news organization.
So, one, you need money, obviously, to start a company. And so you can, if you're independently wealthy, you can fund it. We weren't, certainly not wealthy enough to fund a company. And so then you either have to like take out loans or you raise money. And we decided right away we were going to raise venture capital. And we knew because we had success at Politico that we'd be able to raise at a decent valuation. You know, valuation is how much is your company worth, even though it doesn't exist. And then the amount of money that you raise, you're giving up that percentage. So I think our initial valuation was $33 million post money and 23 pre, and we raised 10. So right off the bat, we had $10 million. Then we did another round maybe 18 months later. And then recently, right before the virus, we raised another 20. We've not touched the second or third round. And basically, we're raising enough money that we don't ever want money to be the we don't want that to like cause angst internally. We want to be able to recruit people. We want to be able to be basically, if we wanted to do an acquisition, have the money to do an acquisition. If God forbid we went to war or you have a virus, that we could stomach an economic downturn. And so luckily we've done well, and we've actually done very well through the virus, kind of surprisingly so. And
I don't think it's that surprising. Like I get my virus news from Axios, right? So.
Yeah, but we're relying on advertising and when other companies they pull back, but we actually just had the best quarter we've ever had. So we're doing well because people are interested in news, and I think serious people increasingly do turn to us for their news. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've raised a decent amount of money. We still control the company. You know, I'm the chairman and the CEO. Everybody at our company is a shareholder. That's really important to us. Yep. We're a different type of company. If you work at our company, you have access to every piece of information except for how much people make and then why they leave. And we do that out of respect.
Very interesting.
So, but if you worked for us and you wanted to know how much money we made this month or where we're spending money or why we're doing what we're doing, we have full transparency.
I love that. I think that's great. And I'm sure that your company culture, since you're kind of creating a culture of transparency from the top, I'm sure that that reflects as it trickles down to junior employees who are starting at the company. So I'm sure that's doing you a favor in the long term. What was your pitch to investors? Because at the time, I get your thesis to make you smarter, faster on what matters. But if it's just kind of words coming out of your mouth, I have to imagine that you got turned down a few times. So what was the pitch to investors in the early days?
There's definitely some venture funds that took a pass. For the most part, it wasn't that hard for us to raise money, only because we had done Politico and Politico was successful. So we could point to that. And if you're investing in somebody who's had success, who has a good idea, you're in a pretty strong position to raise money. So our pitch was, listen, we've got this amazing roster of people who are going to come with us. We've done it once before. We know how to make money off of media. It's an important space. We have, an authentic innovation. And you ride with us. If we're right, we could be the next CNN. And you can be part of it. And people, we've got great, every one of our investors from the beginning has been in every additional round. They're great. You know, we've got NBC. We've got Lorene Powell Jobs. We've got Graycroft. We just brought in Gladebrook. We've got an amazing roster of individuals and institutions. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's an interesting space. Like, it can be very helpful. They have connections. They have experience. And at times can be quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how did you personally have to evolve your leadership style, you know, even at Politico, coming from being a journalist to being a leader, an entrepreneur, and even at Axios, how did you personally evolve your leadership style?
I mean, it's radically different today than when I started. I mean, remember, I was joke, but it's not a joke. The only thing I had run before we started Politico was I would manage a couple of shifts at a Little Caesars in high school while I was working. So like I've never run anything. And I was instantly in a top leadership job at Politico, helping launch a company, run a company. And at the time, I'm pretty maniacal about my work. Very few people are probably going to outwork me in terms of effort. And I kind of assumed everyone else would work that hard, and I would ride people to work as hard as I worked. And it worked like for people who are adrenaline junkies, but it was, I think, exhausting for a lot of people. I think a lot of people burnt out, they left, and I never thought that much about culture or like trying to find people who have different skill sets. And so I pretty quickly had to self-correct. And I'd say over the last decade, I'd like to think that I've become a good leader, largely because I was humble enough to see all the deficiencies of my leadership. Yeah. And now, like, I spend almost all my time communicating internally and externally about what we're trying to do. Like, people want to know. People care about the higher purpose. Like, I have to live it. It has to be authentic. It has to flow naturally from me. I spend a lot of time thinking about diversity and inclusion. We have a very diverse team at Axios, and that's really important, and that requires a lot of work and a lot of people thinking about that. Our big things are candor. I'm not going to say something to you I wouldn't say to somebody else. I'm very transparent. There's very little bullshit when I talk, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And then transparent. Like, I can't say we're a transparent company and not be transparent myself. Like, transparent about the good things we do, and if we screw something up, transparent about the things that we got wrong. And so I would like to think that I've evolved into a good leader, and I'm lucky that I have an executive team full of amazing leaders. And again, I go back to that point. Like, I think about this all the time. Like, if you just take Mikey out of my life, I don't know that I would have been successful. Like, he is like a way better journalist. He's works even harder than I do, but also is like the most humble person ever. Like, seriously, like the most humble, gracious person I've ever met on earth, not just worked with. And so he's kept me grounded. He's able to point out things, like maybe when we're getting a little too cocky, he's able to really help me empathize with what other people might be going through. So yeah, I say that in that, like, you're really only as good at a company as the people around you. And I think we've gotten good at attracting, we call them killers with humility, like basically people with killer talent. Like, you can't replace talent, but that have the humility to put the cause above themselves, that care more about getting people smarter faster than they do about their own career advancement. And I really believe in that. I've never been a sharp elbow person. I've always believed in meritocracy. I believe if I work really hard and do the right thing, like the right thing, both like by work and sort of morality, that good things happen, and only good things have happened to me in my career because of that. And so we don't tolerate backbiting. Like, we'll fire somebody if we hear them talking behind people's back at work and being jerks to their colleagues. It just, we will reject you. It will not work at our company. And therefore we have, like, really, people always say, like, one of the best things I heard maybe in my career was twice in a 2-week period earlier this year, maybe late last year, two different people at our Virginia headquarters, we were getting in the elevator and pushed the floor that we're on. And they're like, "Oh, you work on the happy floor." And I thought, like, that is such an awesome thing that people, yeah, like,
that's a compliment.
Which must mean our people are kind in the elevator, nice to other people. Like, that's cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is cool. And that is a compliment. And one of the factors that I really find super intriguing in regards to the Axios story is, and this is, I think this seems unique to news organizations. You know, if you go on CNN or MSNBC or various other companies, I don't necessarily think you see this, but on the Axios homepage, with two clicks, you can go right to the company's manifesto. And it has basically all the traits that Axios strives for, you know, to make you smarter, faster on what matters. That seems like it's your mission there. But you also state that the bottom line is to strive to be worthy of your time and trust always. And it seems like trust is at the core of the Axios brand. And I think that's very timely because, unfortunately, mistrust in media is low. So why was trust a very important part of the Axios thesis when starting out, and how have you been able to follow through with that vision?
Yeah, I mean, because you've talked a little bit about it so far, that, like, sadly, more than half the American public doesn't believe a damn thing that the mainstream media produces. And that's sad. And it's not just ideologues. It's like smart, educated people in my life, I'm sure in your life, they no longer trust what they see, read, or hear. And that's dangerous. And so one of the things that galvanizes people who work at Axios is we're trying to do everything in our power to get people who are persuadable to believe that we're trying to get to the closest approximation of the truth, that we're trying to help them better understand these topics. Because if we don't, if there's not a common set of facts, if there's not sort of common understanding, you end up with this divisiveness that you see on social media amplified, yeah. and you end up making really bad decisions across the board. And if you ask me about the things I worry, you're 17. How old are you?
Yeah, 17.
You're wise beyond your years, by the way. You think about the things that I worry about for you, and I have two sons, 16, 15, and a daughter I just mm-hmm. took off to North Carolina. I was in college. What I worry mm-hmm. about, I worry a lot that you're going to be entering a world where there's all these people living in bubbles that only consume things that make them feel good. And they're not understanding mm-hmm. that like some things are just true. Like, I'm sorry, I can't have a conversation with someone who says that global warming doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You can
yeah.
tell me it might not be as dangerous as some of the scientists think, or that the trade-offs of having to maybe sort of stranglehold a portion of the economy to be able to get an appreciable mm-hmm. change in the short term isn't worth it. But if you're telling me that every single scientist in the world who's looked at temperatures and seen that you've had whatever 20 of the 21 warmest years in the history of the planet in the last 21, like, I can't have a serious yeah. conversation with you.
Yeah, we're going in circles.
Like some things are just real. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, we see it with the fake news stuff, but yeah, it animates us a lot. And we live it by like anybody who works at our company, whether you're a journalist or not, we ask you not to express your opinions in public platforms. We ask you not to back political candidates in any public way. We ask you not to give money to political causes. And the reason that we do those things is that I want to be able to signal to the reader, the listener, the viewer that we're trying. Like, we're imperfect. Like, I screw up stuff every single day. And I'm sure there's days where we're too ideological on this or not ideological on that. But we're trying. And I do think for our core reader, we do have their trust. I think they think we're trying to do our damnedest to give them the set of facts and the context so that they can make better decisions.
I think at this point, it's practically embedded into the Axios brand. And so I would say you've succeeded in that mission, especially for your core group of readers, listeners, viewers, etc. I think the main thing that interests me is just media is so divisive these days. If you're right, then you'll just watch Tucker Carlson ramble all day. And if you're on the left, then you're going to watch CNN. And it's just very catered to kind of your beliefs and isn't really interested in expanding your perspectives. And so that's why I think Axios is really interesting. And I think it's beneficial that the company isn't necessarily associated with a political party and is just trying to make you smarter faster. And so I really resonate with the mission. So talk about, like the organization as a whole is focused on, it seems like it's focused on technology, media, business, and politics. Those are the main four pillars that kind of differentiate you from the rest of the crowd. That's not saying you're only covering those yep. topics, but that's the main sections of interest that Axios takes part in. So why are those four pillars, technology, media, business, and politics, why are they extremely important in 2020? Why focus on them?
Well, because if you think about it, almost every new idea, every new company, mm-hmm. every cultural battle and every political battle is the result of a collision between technology, how people consume and disseminate information, and the political environment. Like basically everything is those three things in constant collision. And I think technology maybe being the biggest animator mm-hmm. of it all. And so what we try to do is we try to cover those topics and connect the dots for people so that they can separate fact from fiction, so that they can have some context to understand why an antitrust debate about Facebook is about something larger than whether or not Facebook has to give up WhatsApp, that it's about mm-hmm. you know, that it's about yeah. how people are consuming and disseminating information, whether or not you have to regulate a big platform like Facebook the way that I'm regulated as someone who runs a media company. And mm-hmm. so those topics, they're broad, right? They cover a lot. Like inside of technology, you have robotics. Inside of technology, you have AI. Inside of technology, you have the big four or five companies. And so to us, we're always thinking, okay, what if you're 17, what are the topics that are going to shape your next 5 to 10 years? Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that we spend a lot of time on. We have newsletters on the changes to big cities, because I think that's where all the action is going to be. We have, which covers 5G. We have newsletters on robotics, science, China. Like, these are big, meaty topics that like your generation's going to need to learn about. And like, and by the way, your generation is going to have to clean up a lot of the messes that our generation made with a lot of these technologies and a lot of these problems. And fundamentally, I am optimistic. Going back to your truth thing, I am optimistic. What keeps me optimistic is a cable TV is not humanity. It's not America. Twitter is not humanity. It's not America. Most people are good people. Most people are hardworking people. Most people aspire to be a good neighbor, to help somebody out, to volunteer, to do their job, to live by the rules, and to try to leave the earth in a better place than it was when they got here. And I think it's a little distorted right now because Donald Trump obviously distorts the hell out of everything, but Twitter distorts the hell out of everything, and cable distorts the hell out of everything. And a lot of these technologies they're new, right? Like the iPhone and Snapchat and Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and Facebook. If you think about the scope of advancement or the scope of a company, they're babies. They're 10, 12 years old, in some cases much younger than that. And it's going to be your generation's job to figure out, okay, you guys had your fun with these, or you guys misbehave with all these awesome tools. And how do we set some rules so these are actually net beneficial for our species? Right. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's going to fall upon, you know, my generation, but very largely on your generation.
Coming up, my conversation continues with Axios co-founder and CEO Jim VandeHei. The Ones Who Succeed will be right back after a brief word from our sponsor. This is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. Welcome back to the program. And I'm joined by Axios co-founder and CEO Jim VandeHei. So we're going to jump right back into that conversation. How has your execution at Axios stayed true to the original mission? Because as a media company becomes more prominent, and Axios certainly is, as you start to get more and more opportunities. I've heard many interesting entrepreneurs say that what makes them successful is the combination of opportunities they've turned down versus accepted. And I'm sure that's true in your case. So how have you gone about executing your vision at Axios? And I'm sure you've turned down opportunities.
We turned down a ton, but we really have, like, in that manifesto, like, it hasn't changed. We haven't really had to update it, right? Like, it is, we are about, like, does this fundamentally help people get smarter, faster on things that matter? Mm-hmm. And that allows us to sift out a lot of things. We don't do things just to have a big audience. We don't do things just because it might make money. We don't do things that might be long and not useful to the audience. Like, we really try to be as smart and as efficient with people's time, respectful of their time. Mm-hmm. And, like, that does, you lots of things come your way, and you just sort of filter them out. And we know that clarity of purpose, if you ever can get it when you're running a company, is beautiful. Like, because the filter is, it's just always there. You don't even really have to sit there and debate it. Anything that comes to us, we know instantaneously, yeah, that would never fit. Yeah. And because we had done this, the value of screwing stuff up, if you have some humility, is immeasurable. Like, almost everything that we do now that we get so right was because we got it so wrong once or twice before. And now we kind of know, how do you do it? How do you structure a company? How do you engage a leadership team? How do you keep your workforce feeling, like, special and feeling included and feeling motivated? Like, it is you learn these things and then you apply them. And as long as opportunities are fit into our thing, like getting a podcast, because there's some people who want to get smart brevity and get our content, but they don't want to read. They want to listen to a 10-minute podcast in the morning. Okay, that fits very nicely with what we're doing. HBO came along, said, we love your content. It's so smart. It's such an interesting frame. Let's do a show, and let's keep it shorter. Let's keep it really smart. Let's keep it around these big consequential topics. Yeah, let's do that. That's great. Yeah. We can reach a new audience, good business. Boom, we're in. And my guess is you'll continue to see a lot more of that from us, but you're not going to suddenly see us covering the Kardashians or something like that.
Let's hope not. And you actually mentioned Axios on HBO, and I wanted to talk about it because, you know, maybe not surprisingly, I'm a big media nerd, and I appreciate high quality media. And Axios on HBO is extremely well put together. So great job to you and your team on that. So, and you kind of mentioned this, but if we can go a little bit more in depth before we wrap up here, how did that opportunity come up? When you were working on the show deal with HBO, did you plan or intend to step on Vice's toes a little bit? Because I've watched Vice on HBO for quite a while too. Can they coexist? What's the thinking there?
Yeah, I've never, that I can think of it, we've never built a product to compete with somebody. We always are thinking about, like, what is it that we think we can execute in a way that would be meaningful and profitable? And mm-hmm. So the HBO show came about because Richard Plepler, who used to run HBO, was one of the people when we were transitioning from Politico to doing Axios that we went and consulted and said, hey, this is what we're going to try to do. Like, you've been a good friend over the years. Love your advice. And he gave us some advice. But then he also said, and by the way, I would love to do a show with you guys one day. Mm-hmm. And we didn't immediately say, let's do a show. We waited until we had our footing. And he came and said, we should really think hard about this. And this is where you have to know what you do well and don't do well. We said, I'd love to. We've got access to these people. We can deliver the president or Elon Musk or other people. We're really good on news. We're not TV people. I don't know how to produce a beautifully shot show that appears on HBO. And so he paired us up with another person who was a friend of mine, Perry Peltz, who was a documentary filmmaker who had done a lot of work with HBO. And she had a partner, Matt O'Neill. And it was magical because they were huge fans of Axios. They had done a lot with HBO. And instantly, like within a half hour, we had such a rhythm of, this is how you would turn Axios into a documentary news show. And we're like, we're in. And that was off to the races. It was pretty successful from the beginning. It's been renewed, you know, now. I think we're renewed through this year and next year. We just had a Trump interview that did quite well.
I saw it all over Twitter, all over various news organizations. Well, I think the style is just so unique. I've never seen anything like it. And so I think that resonates with audiences, especially the Axios audience. But I'm sure people have found out about Axios through the show. So it was almost a beneficial marketing play. But Axios has a few co-founders who you mentioned at the beginning of this program came from Politico with you. How do you divvy up the workload between your co-founders and what does your day look like? I'm sure it's a little bit different now with COVID.
Yeah, so the co-founders were sort of the official co-founders would have been Roy Schwartz, Mike Allen, and myself. Mike Allen is he's probably the most connected, hardworking journalist maybe ever, but certainly in the country today. And he's very much focuses on content. He writes this daily newsletter called Mike Allen's AM Top 10. It's just an amazing, essential reading. And he also is a great mentor to young journalists and has a great antenna for news. And so he tends to be very editorial focused, though he has brilliant observations on what to do with the business. Roy, who came to us a couple years into Politico from outside the media space, is definitely like the business genius. Like, he is great at deals. He's great at strategy, understands sales, understands structure. And that's his bucket of things that he owns. Mm-hmm. And then I tend to focus on very broad strategy for the company, how we sort of think and talk about ourselves internally and externally, and probably a little bit more than them, spend a lot of time doing the cheerleading and making sure that we keep everybody excited and mark about what we're going to do. And so we've been together now a decade. We agree on everything, though we have obviously real lively debates about what to do, but we are friends. We respect the hell out of each other. We all work extremely hard. We're, I think, all really good colleagues to each other and to other people. So it's like the one of the, other than my wife and kids, like, it's probably one of the relationships that I that sort of co-founder relationship that I cherish as much as I've cherished any relationships in my life.
Yeah.
And my days are, there's not a real good way to describe it. Like, I dabble in content. I help with some of the production of the TV show. I think a lot about strategy. I spend a lot of time with our executive team on new business lines. I spend a lot of time trying to think about how do we expand our coverage? How do we get attention for the coverage that we get. So I don't have sometimes the best attention span. So it works well for me because I can bounce from topic to topic and I find that very invigorating. I don't feel like some people want to know what they have to do. I don't mind my day being meandering and wild, and I find that refreshing and yeah, it gives me energy.
All right. And a few more questions here. What's your financial goal with Axios? Because you, when you take venture money, typically you are essentially on the clock to either IPO or get acquired and provide some form of exit for your investors. And you've raised quite a bit of money from venture investors, like you mentioned at the middle of the show here. So do you see Axios being a publicly traded company? Do you see potentially getting acquired by a larger conglomerate like Turner? Or how do you see the financial side of Axios in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is I don't know yet. One, like people signed up with patience. Like they love, I think they like being on the board or like being investors in a media company. I think they like us and believe in us and believe that we'll continue to grow at a pretty impressive rate. So they have faith in us. So we've got time. I do think it's important. Like people are shareholders and are people invested in us to, this is capitalism. They want to make money. I want to make them a lot of money. Like, I'm personally not that motivated by money. Like there's things that are much more important to me, but like it's a for-profit company. So like we want this thing to be a multi-billion dollar enterprise that everyone gets rich off of. And I'm not ashamed to say that. That's what our job is in terms of being the stewards of the company. And now, and like for our employees, like part of their pay package is that they're betting on us. They're betting on the stock that they have. And so I want people to make money off of this if we're a successful company. And we're going to be a very, very successful company. So that could take many forms. It could be that we do an IPO, unusual for media companies, but I think that if we keep growing the way we are, I don't think it's unfathomable that we would go public at some point. You could sell all or some of the company to a bigger company or to a different player. That's always an option. But for us, having full control is really important because we think we're good at this and we're very protective of the environment and very protective of our employees. So we'd always want to be in control of that. But there's different ways to get those moments where people can get some cash out of the company that they created. And, you know, I guess the timetable is we're 4 years in. I think you really start to think about those things at year 7, year 8, unless something really like some kind of showstopper comes up before then. But I think we have some time, and there's a lot of directions that this company could go in, and we're going to end up having another very good year this year. And like, I'm not in any hurry to do something else. I don't know what else I would do, by the way. Like this is what I do. Like, I guess I could run a different media company. I don't know if I want to do another startup. Like I'm getting old, but it's just fun. And if you can do it, like people listening to your podcast, like are probably listening because they are entrepreneurs, like do it. Like, even if you fail and when you're young, do it. It is so much fun. Like it's like a drug, and it is a fun, healthy drug. And you get to learn so much about yourself and other people and humanity and business. And like the education you get is just so invaluable. And, you know, and I tell anybody who's young, like do what you love doing until you truly have an obligation to do something just for money. Like you might have kids or you might have a sick parent at some point where you truly just have to make money. For most people, that's pretty late in life. So like keep doing things that like make you happy with people who make you feel good about yourself. And you're going to have a pretty damn good life and probably a pretty good career. I think if you can align those things. And like, I'm blessed that I have all of that. And like, I want to keep it going.
Very well said. Awesome. Well, thank you, Jim, for taking the time to come on the program.
Thank you. Take care. I look forward to hearing it.
That's Jim VandeHei, one of the ones who succeed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I really appreciate it. If you want to see clips from the show and stay up to date with what I'm working on, you could follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Campbell J. Barron. And my YouTube channel is my name, Campbell Barron. You've made it to the end of the show. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Campbell Barron, and I'll be back in no time.